All right, there we go. All right, so we are holding on Kofiud Tesamad Aleph, second line. The Mishnah said, "Veloy Mishem Repeitus." Below that, you're not allowed, among other things that you're not allowed to buy because we're afraid that the person may have stolen them, is people whose job it is to watch fruit in an orchard or whatever. You're not allowed to buy from them fruit or wood because they may have taken it without. They may have taken it illegally. So Gemara tells Rav, well, on the side of it here, it says it's supposed to be either Rav or either Rava, either Rava or Rava, as the case may be. We're going to see Rabbi asked him. Whatever it is, Zavin Shabishta Me'arisa. He one time bought branches, a bundle of branches, from an oris, from a sharecropper. What happened to what it says in our Mishnah about not buying wood from them because they may have taken it illegally? Amalei, he says to him, Hani Mila B'Shomer Delesle B'Gufer Da'ara Midi. Yes, but that only applies to a watchman who doesn't actually own anything in the karka per se or anything that's attached to it. His job is just to watch it. His job is not—he's not supposed to be taking anything. He gets paid in money.
Anyone else? Yes.
Abel Oris the Islay Begave. But when it comes to a sharecropper, he has a certain share in the field, or at least in the product of the field, because that's the way it works with an Oris. Is you divide up. You as we'll see soon. That's as we'll see soon. Usually an Oris would get a third or a quarter or whatever, so a certain percentage of the branches, let's say the branches that have to be pruned off the trees or the vines or whatever, do belong to him. Well, very well then. In that case, he may be selling them legitimately. Ema, therefore, we can say that he's selling stuff that really belongs to him. Yeah. There is, by the way, an interesting machlokes between the Tur and the Beis Yosef on this. This applies fine if we know that the Oris and the Balabas already divided what's supposed to be divided their respective shares. What if we don't know they divided yet? The Torah says in that case maybe not. He might be taking it and he won't tell the guy. He won't tell the owner afterwards that the Balabas that he took X amount that he should deduct it from his part. Whereas the Beis Yosef argues with that. The Beis Yosef says it's fine in that case also.
Why they can divide afterwards?
Because we assume that he will tell him. We shouldn't assume Mela if you have a case where there's strong reason to suspect that it's stolen. Yeah, but here where ultimately, you know, they are going to be dividing it. We should assume that fine. He'll tell the Balabas at the time that he took X amount.
It's okay to sell the chesed cash the same, or you can't.
It's kind of a chesed cash, yeah.
Also, you can always say, "I can always be worried. Maybe he'll meet the Balabas and show."
Yeah,
and I'll tell my boss from your guy.
Yeah, that's also. These fruit watchmen, you are allowed to buy from them when they're sitting and selling and they have baskets in front of them, and a big balance scale in front of them, because then it's all, they're doing it in a very public way, like the way that merchants usually do it. So then they're not doing it illegally. If they're doing it like that, you know, they're sitting there with a scale and everything, the whole nine yards, it means they're doing it. It means it's on the up and up. It means they're selling stuff of their own. We can just presume that they wouldn't be doing it in such a way so publicly if it was stuff that they had stolen, where then they'd be afraid the Balabas might walk by any time and catch it. But in all these cases, if they tell them, as we said in the Mishnah, hide what you purchased from me, then it's also, because then we know there's something fishy going on. Furthermore,
and therefore we're not allowed.
Leichin mehen mepetach hagina. Furthermore, you're allowed to buy from them when it's at the front of the garden. Avaloi me'achori hagina, but not when it's behind the garden. Because again, if it's side door or whatever, then maybe there's something sneaky maybe going. Mepharshim talk about the. Do we mean that it has to be both? Does it mean it has to be both? He has to have the scales and everything and be sitting at the front, or is it one or the other? If he has the scales and everything, it's fine, even if it's in the back. Yeah, different ways that the Mefarshim understand it. Gazlon, ma'emesem mutu lifnos hemenu. At what point are you allowed to buy things from a gazlon? Rav ma abshtei roi mishaloi. Rav says you have to wait until the majority of what he has, the majority of his mammon, belongs to him and is not something that's stolen. Then fine, you can go according to the roi and you can buy from him. It means exactly what it sounds like. If we know that he stole X amount, and we know that he stole, let's say, $100 worth of stuff, but we know that his net worth now is $300, then we're good. $200 of what he owns is his own stuff. Only $100 of it is stolen. So then you can buy and assume that what you're buying comes from the road. Or Shmuel Amafil Mirchalai. Shmuel says even if a minority is his, because we can assume that what you're buying from him is his own. I know you have the obvious question, so wait a second.
I do.
Yeah, I can see it on your face. Rabbi Yehuda paskened to Ada Daila. Ada was his name, and Daila Rashi says means Shamash Rabbanon. He served the Chachamim. This is, by the way, where they get in modern Hebrew. Dayal means a steward, like on an airplane. They get it from there.
Dayal,
yeah. I mean, yeah. So he passed for him, Kedivra Omer, Afila Miut Shaloi, like the opinion of Shmuel, that even if the Miut belongs to him, it's fine. So now, what happened to what we learned in the Mishnah about not buying from the shepherds, etc.? So there's a number of different approaches. That's a number of different approaches that the Mefarshim have. The Magen Mishnah talks about a couple of them. One of them is there may be a difference between, in the Mishnah, we're talking about the roiv of this kind of item. When a shepherd sells this particular kind of item, for example, the most of the time it's stolen. Therefore, you have a problem with it. Here we're talking about more generally that there's a chashad on all of the guy's mammon, generically, what of it is stolen and what's not. Then you can say that even if only a miut of it is his own and a majority of it is stolen, there's nevertheless reason, there's more reason to assume that that he's selling his own stuff. There's also, he talks about another possibility is maybe, in fact, the Rambam passes according to our mission and he also passes according to Shmuel. So how does that fit? So another possibility is maybe we distinguish between a ganav and a gazlan in that regard. Our Mishnah is talking about where he takes it secretly, a ganav. Here we're talking about Rav and Shmuel are talking about a gazlan. There's reason to distinguish between them. With all that said, though, there is the Rav Moshe Kazis, one of the early Achronim, points out that maybe the girsa over here shouldn't be liknois, but rather like onois, meaning to have anah. In which case, you're not necessarily talking about buying things from him, per se. Then, Taki, you might have the situation. We're talking about, for example, borrowing from him, let's say, a ganav or a gazlan, as the case may be. What does he do? He steals things in order to resell them, in order to get money for them. He wouldn't be stand lending them out or whatever. So, therefore, if you're lending it out, there's more reason to assume, even if most of what he owns is stolen, there's more reason to assume that what he's lending out is from that minority that is that's not stolen. By the way, there are some Rishonim who paskin like Rav in this case, because the reason to paskin like Shmuel are, number one, we see that Yehuda paskin like him and Maaseh Rav, and number two, because usually the halacha is like Shmuel and Dinei Mamonos. On the other hand, we're also dealing with a matter of Isser over here, the Isser of buying from a gazlan. So maybe in that case, the rule with Isserim is the halacha is like Rav. There are some Rishonim who paskin like Rav in this. So you have to roiv of his possessions have to be his own.
So Gazlan sells his goods, and with the money he buys other goods. Are these other goods considered stolen because he bought them from stolen money, basically?
No. I mean, you not necessarily should be you'll be buying from him for a different reason, because you're machazik the over avera. He's not gonna if he's not able to do business with people, he may stop stealing. But that's yeah. The objects themselves are not going to be considered yet. Onward. Mamon and Moser. Now, what happens to the money and the possessions of a Moser? So we learned the other day the whole thing about a Moser, somebody who informs on Jews to where the government is going to take it illegally, or where the mafia is going to take it, or whatever. We talked about all the pros and cons of that. We also talked about over there that according to most Rishonim, you're allowed to kill a Moser. We talked about over there, the Kahana breaking the guy's neck. There are some Rishonim who... So one second. First of all, there are Rishonim who say that only if you're allowed to maybe indirectly cause their death, but not directly. Meridin, for example, say to throw into a pit, and then they die on their own there, as opposed to like Rav Kahana did, literally breaking the guy's neck. That's first of all. Second of all, though, the Rambam makes another distinction, which is accepted, la halacha, which is there's a difference whether the guy has mastered yet or not. If he hasn't, if he's threatening to master and hasn't yet, that's when the halacha is that you're allowed to kill him. If he already mastered, then no. Then it's like the equivalent of the Baba Machteris who's running away. At that point, killing him isn't going to accomplish anything unless he's already done it several and habitually does it, where then he may do it again and again, then already, yeah.
Well, that's an assumption that he would do that.
Well, no. If he only does it one or two times, that doesn't create a chazaka yet that he's going to do it. So each time, if he says, "I'm going to master," like that guy in the story the other day, "I'm going to master on that guy,"
he knows he's going to be killed.
Not necessarily. Sometimes
very
he
likely.
He didn't. In that case, the guy didn't know that Rakhana was going to break his neck. It can happen that a person is making noises about that he's going to go and master. at that point, the halacha is hitzeratz melemisa. If they have a chance to kill him, they
have to be killed.
Not allows himself. Hitzeratz melemisa means he said something which thereby now he's chayav misa for it. If they kill him, then fine. You know, they've done a good thing by saving his intended victim. But once he already mastered, if he's not doing it habitually, then you're not allowed to. So here, either we're talking about it's a habitual one where he's going to do it again and again, and therefore he's always hitzeratz melemisa, or we're talking about where he's threatening to and hasn't yet. That's the case, maybe. So now we're dealing with, what about his monk? Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, argue about it. Chadam mutul abde biyad. One says you're allowed to destroy it directly. Chadam also abde biyad. The other one says you're not allowed to directly destroy it.
His money, his
possessions, or whatever. Mando am mutul abde biyad, because he says, look, lo yehim amoyne chomim gufa. You can't be more strict with his money than with his guf. You'd be allowed to kill him. Therefore, his money is also free for destroying, if you want.
If you go for like the local
way. He says, yes, but he may end up having children or other heirs who will be good. Not necessarily because he's a Rasha, are all of his descendants going to be Rashaim? And after all, you have a pasuk that says, Yachin Rasha, the Tzadik Yodosh. The pasuk doesn't actually say the word Rasha, the Gemara is sticking it in to explain the pasuk. The Rasha prepares, and the Tzadik ends up wearing. Marsha points out, though, the Gemara knows from context, it's a Perek and Eiv over there talking about Rishayim, that we can tell over there, Marsha explains, if you look at Sukkim carefully, you can see that we're talking about this kind of situation, a Moiser, who nevertheless has good children who will end up inheriting what he has. So therefore, don't go destroy his mammon, let it be saved for his children. The Mordechai actually says that even if you're not allowed to destroy it, you're allowed to, let's say, for example, if he lends you money, you're allowed to keep it for yourself rather than return it to him. And then the Marshal says on that, wait a minute, what happened to Yochanan the Tzadik Yobosh? Give it back so that his children eventually will inherit it. So in this connection, speaking of this, that a Tzadik ends up getting something from a Rosha, Rav Chista Havalei Hahu Arisa, Rav Chista had a certain Aris to have a Tokil V'Yohiv Tokil V'Shokil. He used to weigh and give and weigh and take. The Rashi says two explanations what it means. One is that he was very, very precise. He wouldn't, when it came time to divide, that Rav Chista is supposed to get some of the produce, and he's going to get some of the produce, he'd do to the last crumb, not be mevatur even the slightest bit of his own. That's one. And the second explanation, Rashi says, is usually an oris is entitled to a third or a quarter or whatever, according to whatever is made up. This guy insisted on taking half. Marshall argues with both of those. Takil v'yahiv means he weighed and gave Rav Chista his portion, and takil v'shakil, and he weighed and took his portion. Marshall argues with both of those explanations of Rashi because he says the Gemara is going to call him a Rosha. Neither of those things makes him a Rosha, neither the fact that he's precise to the nth degree, nor the fact, okay, he's taking a 50% like he's not supposed to. Fine, take him to Beis Din or whatever, you know. So Marshall gives a different... Marshall gives a different explanation, which is that this guy illegally had two sets of weights, which we know from the couple of parashiyos ago it's also to do. He would use the Midaraisa. So he would use the larger set of weights when he's weighing out his portion and the smaller set of weights when he's weighing out Rapista's portion. Daniel Yoda says a variation on that. Maybe what the guy did is he weighed out Rav Chista's produce when it's fresh, and he weighed out his own produce when it's dry, so therefore you get more, because it dries out, so therefore it weighs less. Whatever. So Rav Chista fired him. And he said on himself, this is like the Pasuk says, the Sofon not Tzadik Cheo Choyte. There is hidden away for the Tzadik the wealth of the sinner. This guy was a sinner, this guy was a Baal Averus, and whatever of these ways, and therefore I end up getting what he stored up for himself. There's a pasuk that says, another pasuk in Eov over there talking about Rishoyim. It's in the same context a few pasukim earlier than that Yochin v'tzadik Yobosh, which is why the Gemara is quoting it up here. The pasuk says, Ki matik vaschonei kiyivza. But what, after all, what is a chonei, a hypocritical person? What does he have to hope for kiyivza, that when he steals, ki yeshel elekan nafshei, that Hashem will yeshel his soul. Now, what does Yeshel mean? Whose soul, and what does Yeshel mean? So, Rav Huna and Rav Chista, they argue what the pasuk means. Chad Omer Nafshei Din Nigzol. One says the Nafshei over here means the soul of the one who was stolen from. So then Marsha explains, in other words, the Eibishter like will punish the Gazlan for taking away the Nigzol and the Shama. Yeshel, he will remove, Meloshin Rashi says, Meloshin Ki Yishal Zeisecha, that Yishal means to throw away. Hashem will throw away the Gazlan's neshama in punishment for the neshama that he took of the Nigzal. The Ravid has
by stealing
from him, as we'll see soon. Yeah. The Ravid has a different explanation that Yishal, according to this, might be Meloshin Yishal. He demands from him. He demands payback from him for having taken the other guy's neshama. Sometimes it can be without an aleph also. V'chadam enafshish or Gazlan. The other explanation is it means the soul of the Gazlan. According to that, then, Yeshal means the Eibishter removes, throws away his neshama, or Yishal again could be Meloshin to Yishal Zaytecha, the Eibishter makes his neshama fall away. So, Mandom and Nafshishal Nigzal, the one who says that Nafshay in this pasuk means the one of the person who was stolen from, because you have another pasuk that expresses this idea. Kain Orchus Kobetseabot. So it is the way of everybody who steals. Es Nefesh Ba'olav Yikach. He takes the soul of the owner of what he took. So therefore, we see that stealing from a person is tantamount to taking his neshama.
Killing him.
Yeah. Mandom and Nafshish or Gazlan, and the one who says that Kiyeshal alakan Nafshay means the Nefesh of the Gazlan, is Dichtiv, because the Pasuk says, Al Tigzal Dal Ki Dalhu. Don't steal from the poor person, even though he's poor, meaning, as Rashi says, even though he doesn't really have anything to steal, don't steal from him the little that he does have. Or Marshal says, Faket, because he's poor and he has nothing else, stealing from him has a bigger impact on him than on a rich person. Anyway. Don't depress the poor person at the shah. Rashi says when it comes to, for example, Maaser Ani, or Leket, or Shechorpeya, that are divided up at the gates of the city, don't cheat him out of them. The passage continues, Ki Hashem Yoriv Rivam, because Hashem will fight on their behalf, the Kova es Kev'ehem Nefesh, and he will steal away the Nefesh, the soul of the person who steals from them. So we see that, therefore, that when a person steals, his neshama gets taken away by the Eibishter. So therefore, nafshay from the pasuk in Iyov, ki yeshal of the kan nafshay has to mean the soul of the galus. The kava means he'll steal. There's a gemara in Rosh Hashanah that points out that the shodash kava kuf veizayin in a couple of places means to steal. The Idach Nami, so okay, what about according to the opinion that it's the soul of the Gazlan, Haksiv Nefesh Baal of Yitzchak, what does he do with the pasuk that we see when a person steals, he's taking the soul of the owner of what he stole? The answer is no. My Bailav the Hashtaf. Okay, the word Bailav over there means the one who currently is in possession of the thing, namely the Gazlan. So this is what happens when a person steals. It's nefesh ba'ol of Yitzchak. He takes his own soul. He's removing his own soul. He himself was in possession of the stolen goods now. Okay. What about, according to the other opinion, what about the one that the Eibishter is going to steal away the soul of the Gazlan? What is he? So we see from that soul of the Gazlan that's at risk, not the soul of the Nigzal. The answer is, Matam, comma. No, according to that, the pasuk is giving a reason. Matam, the kava es kaveim. Why will the Eibishter, so to speak, steal back from the one who steals? Mishum de kavi nefesh, because they themselves stole somebody else's nefesh. Amar Rabbi Yechonon, kol gozel chaver shava prut. If somebody steals even a shava prut from somebody else, kilo noitel neshmas imimenu. It's as if he takes away his neshamosh. Yes, shenema kein ochus kol betzei abotas nefesh v'ol av yikach. Especially, I mean, again, especially if the guy's a poor person, this may be his last prutta. But besides that, also, you know, Al-Pichsidus, the Alter Rebbe talks in a number of places in Tanya, and from that it's brought in a number of places in Siddus. A person puts their whole neshama, a person puts their whole metzius into earning money. Therefore, money, more than anything, money, goods that a person owns, more than anything else, represents a person's whole chayus. He put his whole chayus into earning that prutta. And therefore, you take it away from him. You're taking it. That's also the importance of tzedakah. That's why tzedakah, that's what Al-Tareb explained in a few places in the Gerat HaKodesh, that's the greatness of tzedakah, that you're taking something that you earn with your whole mitzvahs and giving it away. Okay. And furthermore, you have another pasuk that says, V'ocho ksircha v'lachmecha, banecho v'nesecha, it actually says, yoicho banecho v'nesecha, a pasuk in Yirmiyah, that the enemy will eat up your harvest and your bread. They will eat your sons and your daughters. Which means, in other words, Rashi says, once he eats your harvest and your bread, you have no more food. It's as if he ate your sons and daughters, because you're going to feel so bad that you feel so bad you don't have anything to give them. You don't have any food to give them anymore. V'oimer, and you have another pasuk, Mechamas b'nei Yehuda, that the Eibishter is going to punish the goyim because of the chamos. Chamos, as we know, we translate it as violence usually, but in halacha, chamos means that they take something by force, but then they do pay for it. Still, the thing itself that they took may be critical to a person's parnasa or whatever. So mechamas b'nei Yehuda, because of the violence, because of this illegal extortion of b'nei that they did from b'nei Yehuda, asher shavchu dam naki ba'artzem, that they spilled innocent blood in their land. So again, the chamas leads to the spilling of innocent blood because the person has no money or has nothing to make a living with or whatever and ends up starving.
They're giving money.
They give money, fine, but money, you can't eat money. So let's say, for example, they take something that a person needs to do to make a living with. Now he's stuck.
And a person, let's say, sometimes has a good business. They say, yes, I'm not for you,
yes.
You know. Here's $500,000, get that, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They don't want that. I want the business.
Yeah. But Omer, and you have yet another pasuk El Shol El Beis Adamim. The Eibishter says that the famine in Eretz Yisrael because of Shol and because of the bloody family Al Hashemis Es Givonim, because he killed the Givonim, which he didn't kill them directly, as we learned in Yevamos, that he killed the Kohenim of Noiv, and therefore the Givonim lost their Parnassa, because they used to work for the Kohenim, and they chopped wood and drew water. For the Mishkan, basically for the Mishkan. Okay, so the Gemara says, "Maiva Omer." Why do we need all of these? Why do we need all these
psukim?
One should be enough. Because the chitay, because you might say like this: if you only have the pasuk Kain Orchus Kobetzei Abesas Nefesh Ba'al of Yikach, you might think, "Fine, Nefesh Didei." Fine, by stealing from a person, you're harming his own Nefesh. Avol Nefesh Bonav of Noisav Loi, not necessarily are you harming his children. Toshma B'Sav Bonav of Noisav. Therefore, the pasuk from Yirmiyah that mentions sons and daughters. Okay, the chitay Mahanim Milahechad Lo Yohiv Dami. So you might argue, "Fine, that's if you're not paying for it." But chamas, where you're paying, maybe it's not so bad. Even that is considered taking the guy's nefesh. No, not the Bnei Yehuda. The goyim did it to Bnei Yehuda. Okay. That's what the Tosek is saying, that the Eibishter will punish those goyim for doing that. Okay, so you might argue all this is where he does it directly. Not if he does it indirectly. Because where do you ever find that Shaul killed the Givonim? Because he wiped out Noiv, the city of the Kohenim. So you must speak in the Mayim Mazin, which the Kohenim used to supply the Givonim. The Givonim would draw water and chop wood for them, and in return the Kohenim would support them. They'd give them food and water. And now, when the Kohenim are killed out, then the Givonim don't have anybody. They lost their job, and they lost their panasa. They lost their means of support. Therefore, the pasuk considers Shaul as if he killed them. So we see that even indirectly, it has that effect.
They were bad people, these Givonim?
The Givonim, I mean, they're descendants of the Canaanim who had tricked the Jewish people into making a peace treaty with them. And then claiming that they're from a faraway country, and then when they found out the deception, they didn't want to undo the treaty with them and kill them, because it would make a tremendous chil Hashem. So they made them, from now on, you'll be water drawers and water carriers. Rashi mentions at the beginning of this week's parasha, by the way, that such a thing happened in the Midbar also, which is why at the beginning of our parasha, Moshe mentioned Mechote, either the Givonim or some other nation of Canaan or whatever, and that's why it mentions Chote Beitzecha and Shoev Memecha in our your wood choppers and your water carriers in this parasha.
Because
there were other Knanim who did the same kind of thing. They tricked Moshe Rabbeinu and came and yeah. Okay, the Mishnah said avaloichim in a notion. The Mishnah said that you're allowed certain things that you are allowed to buy. For example, we said you're allowed to buy woolen clothes from women in Yehuda or linen clothes in the Galil, because those are things they commonly make themselves and they sell them with their husband's knowledge. So turn up on it. We learn in a Braisa, expanding on that. You're allowed to buy, as we said, woolen clothes from women in Yehuda or linen clothes in the Galil. But you're not allowed to buy from them wine or oil or flour, because those are things that they wouldn't necessarily, that we, if they're selling them, usually they wouldn't be selling them, and we would assume that maybe they took them from their husband stuff without permission. Similarly, you're not allowed to buy these things from slaves or from children. For the same reason. A woman is allowed to sell anything for just a small amount, like 4 or 5 dinar. Could they last as people erosha, where it's just like it's going to be enough for her to buy a tichel for herself? Because we assume that that's something that the husband is not going to object to.
It's the husband's job to
get his wife a tichel, but he doesn't mind if his wife takes some small things, like some small amount of flour or whatever, and sells it in order to raise money for that. Also, again, if they tell you to hide it, then it's also, because then it means that there's something illegal going on. Another din in this connection, Gaboit Stucka Lichemen Dovamort, when it comes, Gaboit Stucka, who's going around collecting Stucka, is allowed to take from women a small amount. Mephoshim disagreed. Does it mean women as well as Avadim Uktanim, or maybe he's limiting this only to women? Maybe Avadim Uktanim, maybe you're not even allowed to take a small amount. Anyway,
just women.
Just maybe just women, yeah. Avaloi Dovamoruba, but not a large amount. Because, again, same idea. A small amount, we assume the husband's not going to be maxed. A large amount, he might be. Babadodin, what about people who work in people who own an olive press? You're allowed to buy from them olives in large quantities. So Rashi says the owner himself, of course, he's allowed to sell whatever he wants. So Rashi says we're still talking about their wives. If the person owns an oil press, you're allowed to buy from his wife a large quantity of olives, because again, she's not going to. She knows that her husband will notice if it's missing. So therefore, if she's selling that quantity, it means she has her husband's permission. There are other mefarshim who explain that badadin over here means the workers in the olive in the oil press. So they don't own the thing. So therefore, it's the same problem as the shepherds in our Mishnah. Again, you know, a small amount they might try to sneak away. A large amount they're not going to. No, so according to Rashi, so according to the other Mepharshim, in other words, we're talking about the workers. We're not necessarily talking about the wives anymore. Okay. And both, I mean, the truth is both dinim are true. It's just how do we understand the word badadin in the Gemara? Okay. Anyway, so you're allowed to buy from them olives in quantity, same idea. V'shemen b'midah, or you're allowed to buy from them oil in quantity. Avaloi zeisim mu'at v'shemen b'mu'at. But you're not allowed to buy from them a small amount of olives or a small amount of oil, because again, they might be sneaking that out. Rav Shimon Gamliel, loichim minoshim zeisim b'moyed, it says on the side here it's supposed to be b'muat, b'golil ha'elyon, you're allowed to buy from women olives b'muat in the upper Galil. Rashi has two explanations of what b'muat means. One is it means a small amount. One is that it does mean a small amount because as the Gemara is going to say in a second, let's continue the sentence. Sometimes it can happen a person is embarrassed to sell it in front of his house. So he gives a small amount to his wife to sell. So therefore, a small amount is not a problem. Why in the Galila Elyon, Rashi says oil is very expensive over there. So the husband would notice even a small amount missing. Therefore, a small amount, you're allowed to, because we assume she wouldn't have sneaked it away because her husband will notice. Mashenkin, though, she's probably doing it legitimately because he himself is too embarrassed to sell it. Rashi has another explanation that b'muat means minamatan. It means from the vat where the olives are taken out of the vat where they're about to be pressed. You don't usually sell them that way. So again, it probably means that it's all above board, that it's all legal. I saw an interesting explanation that it could be the girsa of b'moyed is correct. Because we may be talking about anchalamoyed. Anchalamoyed, you're not really allowed to buy and sell. But if you don't have any money, then you're allowed to. But still, you would only be doing it in small quantities, just enough to have food for the day or to survive or whatever. But the guy would be embarrassed to have everybody know that he doesn't have money, so he'd have his wife do it for him. So therefore, b'moyed, yeah. You have no choice. You got to eat. The Gemara tells the case. In this connection, we mentioned that Gabori Tzedakah are allowed to take from women a small amount, but not a large amount. Ravina Ikla Lebei Mechuza, one time Ravina came to Mechuza, also Noshi Lebei Mechuza, the women from Mechuza came, he was collecting Tzedakah, the women came, Romu Kame Kavli Vashiri, and they piled up in front of him golden chains and bracelets. Kabaminayu, and he accepted it from them as Tzedakah. What about the brayse that we learned? This is a davar meruba on the face of it. Amalei says, "Now, hani levnei mechuzah davar mort ninu. For the people of mechuzah who are rich, this is a small amount. In other words, it all depends on the situation.
They brought it to him.
But the point is, there's still the you might still have to be concerned that they may have taken it without their husband's knowledge. But like this, since they're rich, then it's not a problem. We can assume that their husbands wouldn't mind it.
Knowing that's him, he's the guy that's stuck.
The Sforno on the Pasuk mentions in Parshas Vayakol when it says Vayavoyu Anoshim Al Anoshim that everybody, that women came and brought their jewelry for the Mishkan. It says the men came with the women. Why? He says based on this Gemara over here, it had to be clear that they're bringing it with their husband's consent, because otherwise Moshe wouldn't have been able to accept it. Somebody else points out you don't even need that based on what we're saying over here, that in Mechuzah they were rich, in the Midbar they were also rich. Everybody had 90 donkeys worth of stuff they took out of Mitzrayim. So therefore, yeah. Mishnah says. Muchin shakovis moti, the little pieces of fabric when you comb fabric or whatever, the one shakovis motzi that a laundryman gets out, you know, when you put something in the wash, lint comes off it. So mukhan over here, lint would be a good translation of it. So the lint that a laundryman takes out when he washes the clothes, harei elishaloi, he's allowed to keep it because the small thing, the little bits of fluff and whatever that come off, yeah. He can keep it because we assume the Baal HaBos is not going to be makpid on small amounts like that.
Value.
It has a little value eventually. You can get enough of it to make like a cushion or whatever. Yeah, but what's taken out when you comb the cloth, harei elishal Baal HaBos, that goes to Baal HaBos because that's a larger amount. Yeah, that's a larger amount. The double kosher. We can't assume the owner is makos.
Okay,
a lot of these.
Piece of the ham off, they put it in your pocket.
Yeah.
When you're doing your ham, they
right.
take the extra piece of money
yeah.
pocket.
Well, that's other things we're going to learn about soon. A lot of this stuff, by the way, is, again, it's situational. To an extent, a lot of these dinim depend on what people are normally makbid on at any time and place.
Yes,
right. Yeah, nowadays a person probably wouldn't be makbid even on larger amounts because clothes are cheap or whatever. Yeah.
It's
both the dietary, right. We're talking about the thing. It goes according to what most people in this time and place would get. Kovis notel gimel chutzin, when you give your clothes to a laundry, they're allowed to take off three threads, mehen shaloi, and he's allowed to keep them. So what are the three threads? It actually explains when they sew woolen clothes, they usually add three extra lines, they usually add three extra threads of some other kind of some other color or whatever at the edge of the garment so that like it doesn't unravel so easily. So when you send it to the laundry, then he cuts off those three and then makes the edge nice and even. He's allowed to keep them. Different other mefarshim of different other possibilities. Here he brings one other possibility that it means, you know, how sometimes you put something in the wash and like threads start coming out of it. So if up to three threads start coming out, then he's allowed to pull them loose and keep them for himself. But yes, any kind of real shabbat bites. Any more than that, you have to give them to the owners. If these three threads were black threads on a white garment, which make it look ugly, then he can take everything, even if it's more than three threads, and keep them because we would assume that the Baal HaBos is happy to get rid of them. If a tailor, who was, again, he was given the materials by the Baal HaBos, the thread and everything, if he has enough thread left that you could still sew with it, or he has a piece of cloth, like you were just saying, that's at least three tefachim by three tefachim. Three etzbois by three etzbois. Yeah, a lot of times. Yeah, well, even nowadays, like you want a custom made suit. Yeah, you buy the cloth and give it. Yeah, not always, but it can happen.
No,
yeah.
A lot of women. I wouldn't mind wearing it. She gets the material.
Yeah, there you go then.
And
okay.
The seamist puts it together.
Fine, so that's what we're talking about over here. Yeah, so you gave them the material. So yeah. So if he has left a piece of cloth that's at least three by three etzbois. Then you have to give that bit of thread or that piece of cloth back to the Baal HaBos because it's something useful and he's not moichel on it. But if it's any less than that, then no. Exactly. Yeah. Eventually you can make a quilt out of them or something. Yeah. Another din. Now, what about woodworkers? What a woodworker takes off with an adze is kind of like a small axe. You use it to get off like little splinters of wood off the thing to make plane is something else. We're going to talk about in the Gemara a plane has a different name. It's called rehitni. This is similar, but it looks kind of like an axe, but the blade is set on it differently. Whatever. It takes off small pieces. Masha chorosh, what a carpenter takes off the masad with an ad, harei elishaloi, he's allowed to keep it because small pieces. Splinters, basically. Or bakasho, but what he takes off with a larger axe, harei elishaloi Baal HaBos, then it goes to Baal HaBos, because larger pieces, again, we don't assume he's merchel. If he was working by the Baal HaBos, then even the sawdust, for example, from drilling, goes to Baal HaBos. So what does it mean? What does it mean that it's a Baal HaBos? Rashi says it means if he's a Shechir Yoim. It depends, in other words, Rashi says, whether he's hired by the job or whether he's hired by the day. If he's hired by the job, then we're saying he can keep small splinters and the sawdust and whatever. If he's hired by the day, then everything goes to the Baal HaBos. Other Mepharshim say it's not really a difference of that. It means more literally what we're saying, whether he's working on the Baal HaBos's premises or not, either because, for example, the Baal HaBos is not going to go schlep over to the guy's carpentry shop and take the sawdust home. Mashenkin, if it's in his house, it's there already. Okay. Turn it up on it. Moichin Muchin Minakovis, you're allowed to take lint or flocking or whatever, the stuff that we're talking about, for you're allowed to buy it from a laundryman, Mepnei Shen Shaloi, because as we said in the Mishnah, whatever he gets off the clothes is his to keep. So therefore, yeah, if he gets a whole ball of that together, you can go ahead and buy it from him. Hakovis Nodal Shnei Chutin Oyonin Behen Shaloi, the laundryman is allowed to take the top two threads and he can keep them. Now the Mishnah said three, so the Gemara is going to talk about that soon. Why two? Is it two or is it three? However, here's another din that a laundryman has to be careful about. He cannot put on it more than three hooks, loops. Rashi describes the way it used to work in those days when you have a piece of clothing that you give to the service, you give it to the guy who's going to comb it. What he does first is he wants to stretch it out on a frame so he can comb it. And then the combing, among other things, what it'll do is it'll raise up the nap on it a little, so it'll be a little more fluffy, it'll look nicer or whatever. So the way you do it, Rashi describes, is you take loops, you take loops of rope or string or whatever, and you sew them in different places onto the edges of the piece of clothing. Then you stretch it out, you put it on the frame. And in the art school they have a diagram of it. Showing how it's stretched out on the frame over there with the loops. Then he combs it, and then he cuts off the extra pieces so that it comes out nice and so it comes out square, squared off. So therefore, when you're putting on those loops, you don't want to sew them on too tightly, because then the cloth will get too stretched out. So therefore, you're not allowed to put more than three stitches when you're putting on each one of these loops.
Three stitches for
each loop. And that way, the loop is only held on very weakly, and it's strong enough that you can stretch it onto the frame, but not so strongly that you can overstretch it and end up with more extra material. Also, when you're combing the cloth, you're not allowed to comb it. You shouldn't comb it along the shefty, but rather along the erev. Cloth, you know, is woven. You have the threads that are there in the loom to begin with. They're called the shefty, and then you have the ones that go back and forth. They're called the erev. Depending on the circumstances, for you, typically the Erev threads are thicker than the Shefty threads. They have to go back and forth. They have to be a little stronger. So therefore, when you comb along the Erev, then you're less likely to ruin the garment. If you do it along the Shefty, you may rip it. So you shouldn't comb it along the Shefty, but rather along the Erev. When it comes to evening it out, after you have it stretched out on the frame over there, and you're cutting off the side pieces in order to make it squared off, you should make it even along the length, not along the width. And you're allowed to even it out up to a tefach. So you can take off strips of the material when you're doing that. When you have it stretched out on the frame over there and you're cutting off the ends to make it even, you're allowed to do up to a tefach. The Rav has a different explanation of this that we're talking about. Like if the clothing sort of, like if one part of it shrank, and you're sort of stretching it out in order to unshrink it. Therefore, you may cut off one side in order to even it out with the other or whatever. The maximum you should cut off is a tefach. So thus far the braisa. Now let's start analyzing it. Omar shnei chutin. So we said you can take off two threads. V'anan tanan shalosh. Our Mishnah said three. The answer is like kasha habalimi yohabektini. The braisa is talking about when there's thick threads. Then you're limited to only two. Because three already will be noticeable. The Mishnah is talking about thin ones, so then you can take three. Okay. We said when it comes to combing the garment, you should comb it not along the shefty, but rather along the erev. The shefty is along the length of the cloth, and the erev is along the width of it. Yeah. Okay, but we learn in a braisa the other way around. The answer is lekasha habeglima habesarvela. There's two different kinds of clothing. A glima is something you wear every day. You're not so concerned about the appearance of it. You're more concerned when you're sending it to somebody to comb it out. You want that it should last a long time. So therefore, better let him comb along the erev where it's stronger. So it won't look as nice. Fine, it won't fluff it up as much, but at least it'll last longer because it's a glimmer. It's like a shirt. You don't worry so much about the looks of it anyway. A sarvala is something you wear to look nice. like a jacket or a capota or something there, the appearance of it is more important. So then it's worthwhile to knack it up a little bit, to stroke it against the grain, kind of. Along the chassis, not along the head. It'll make it wear out faster, fine, but it'll look nicer, and the whole point of it is to look nice.
Why you say along the chassis?
Because for one thing, the chassis threads are thinner, because since they're in place and loom, they don't need to be so thick. The Adif threads go back and forth. They need to be a little thicker. And there's also other explanations that Iva distinguishes between a glima is made out of wool and a sarbala is made out of linen, or the other way around. Because it could. There's a real difference in the width of the chassis and the Adif in wool versus linen. None of us are weavers. We're not familiar with this kind of thing. But if we were, then, it would be a commonplace. It would be a commonplace fact. Okay. Onward. We learn in another braise that you're not allowed to buy lint from the comber. It's not his, because like we said in the Mishnah, any lint that he combs out of the garment belongs to the owner. But in places where the minig is that it is his, and then you are allowed to buy it from him, because then fine, we can assume it's his. Did I? Oh, you're right. Yeah, I did. Yes, I did. Yeah. Okay. We said you're not allowed to, when you sew on the loops over there to stretch it out, you're not allowed to sew on each loop with more than three stitches. What do we consider a stitch for this purpose? Is putting the needle into the cloth and pulling it out considered one stitch? Because like when you're sewing, you put in the end of the needle, you pull it out, you poke out the end of the needle through the cloth. You still haven't pulled through the thread yet. Then after it's in and out or out and in, whatever, then you pull the thread through. Is that considered one stitch? Or maybe that's already considered two stitches because it's going in and it's going out. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Okay. We said when you're evening it out, when you're cutting it to size, you should do it along the length, not the width. What about we learn a braisa that says the other way around? The answer is lekasha habe glima habe ham yoni. Again, a glima is like a shirt, which you'd go along the length for the reason that we said before, because along the length the threads will be stronger, therefore it'll last longer. The other one is talking about hemyona, which is a belt.
No, we're talking about cutting.
Okay, but the point. They were talking about cutting, right? We're not talking about brushing it anymore, right? We're talking about cutting it. But still, though, the point is, you wear it along the length. The length is more important than the width, kind of. You see the edges. So therefore, it's more important that the long edges of it should be even out than the short edges. Yeah. Okay. Whereas when it comes to a belt like a gartel, all that's noticeable really are the two hanging ends. So therefore, when you're cutting it to size, you cut the strings or whatever to size rather than the width, rather than along the length of it. You're not allowed to buy from the comber or from the brusher. You're not allowed to buy from him lint. It's not his, like we said in the Mishnah. Over Malkum Shinagu, be a shaloi, but in places where the minig is that the lint belongs to him, and then you're allowed to buy it. In all places, whether the local minig is that the comber is allowed to keep the lint or not, either way, you're allowed to buy from him a pillow that's stuffed with this lint, or the keset mleimuchin, or a cushion that's stuffed with this lint. My time a kanano bishinui, because at that point it's not considered a stolen thing anyway. Even let's say he did steal the lint, but he was already koneh bishinui by putting it into a pillow. So the Ravid and the Magid Mishnah asked. So we learned before that shinui achozul b'riyase is not a shinui. Here, all you have to do is rip open the pillow and the lint is back the way it was.
Right.
And he answers that since over here, we're not talking about it's vadai stolen. The whole point is the sofek. We don't know for sure. This might have been lint that he's entitled to keep. Even if it's not minigam makam for him to keep, fine. He can have lint from his own clothing that after a while he collected together.
So,
it's only a sofek, therefore it's fine. Even such a shinui is good enough. Turn it up on him. You're not allowed to buy from a weaver the following. Here also, the art scroll helpfully provides a diagram that deals with a lot of the details of how weaving is done. In a nutshell, the way you have it is the chassis threads that stay in place, that are along the length of the garment, you put every other chassis thread through loops, which are called mirin, Those loops are like wires with loops in them that are attached to a frame. You have two frames over there. You alternately lift one frame and then the other. Each time you lift one frame, half of every other Sheffy thread goes up, and then you pass the ARIV through it. Then you put it down, pull the other one up, and put the ARIV back through, and thus it gets woven back and forth. The ARIV itself is wound around a spool, and that spool is put inside, in English they call it a shuttle. Which is you throw it back and forth, kind of. They have a name for it in English, a flying shuttle. That's where they get the term shuttle, like for airplanes and whatnot. But you have the spool of thread in there where the thread kind of comes out a little hole on the side of the shuttle over there, and you have there's little pieces of wool or whatever stuffed in over there to keep it from falling out. We're going to be dealing with a lot of the Gemara. These next couple of lines are going to mention the names for a lot of these pieces. So, in lo kan migardi lo irin, so you're not allowed to buy from a weaver the irin, which are the little pieces of wool or whatever that are meant to keep everything to hold the shuttle, to hold the spool inside the shuttle, because they're probably not his. So you're not allowed to buy them from him. You're not allowed to buy from him the loops that are used to hold the chassis threads. Again, because those we can also assume he may have stolen. Punklin, you're not allowed to buy. Punklin are another kind of Erev, where you don't put the, for Rashi describes, but sometimes you have a loom that you weave on standing up. You have the chassis threads hang down instead of being horizontal like in a normal loom. Then you don't use a shuttle for it. Then you just have a hanging thing of Erev thread over there. Same idea. Then we assume it's not it. We assume that material is being supplied by the Balabas. Voleshure pakias, and you're not allowed to buy from him what's left over on the spool, a regular spool of Erev. Again, same problem. Avolotchen man begin menumer. You're allowed to buy from them though a piece of colorful clothing, meaning not only if it's one color, there's no question, because then we can assume it's something that's his. But even if it's many different colors, you would think maybe it means he stole bits of wool from many different things and made like a kind of patchwork thing. Nevertheless, it was kind of a shinui. By the way, the Yerushalmi mentions an interesting thing going back to the guy whose job it is to brush the clothes. It wasn't to wash the clothes, where we said what he's allowed and what he's allowed to take off, or loose threads, what he's not allowed to take off. The Gemara mentioned, the Yerushalmi mentions an Amora, Abba Hoshia, who he was a laundryman by profession. He always wore clothes of one color, so nobody would suspect that he put in threads from other people's clothes. Anyway, returning to here. So you're allowed to buy from him even a piece of cloth that's made from many different colors of wool. We don't assume that he stole pieces from other people, again, or even if he did, he was koneh b'shinui. Erev v'shefi tovi v'arig, and you're allowed to buy from him erev threads or shefi threads that are spun or that are woven. Because again, koneh b'shinui. So Rashi explains, the earring that we said you're not allowed to buy, but if you actually spun them into thread and then made them into a piece of cloth, you're allowed to buy that.
The earring is what?
The earring of the little pieces of wool or whatever that are stuck in to the shuttle over there to keep the spool of Erev thread in place, to keep it from falling out. Okay, question is, Amri hashta tovi shakli orugubaya. If you're allowed to buy from him even tovi, where it's only spun into thread, but it hasn't yet been yarn, whatever, but it hasn't actually been woven into anything yet, how much more so you're allowed to buy from him something that's woven? Why do we need to mention woven, b'chlal? The answer is my orig tiki, because the word woven over here doesn't mean woven as chessy native. It means it was made into like chain, like macrame sort of. Like he braided it into, and it's not yet spun, but he took like the raw wool and braided it into like a chain. You're allowed to buy that from him already, because that's enough of a shit. Now talking about a dyer, somebody who dyes clothes, or who dyes cloth or thread or whatever for a living. You're not allowed to buy from him oisos, which is, Rashi says, you bring him a piece of cloth to dye. He cuts off a little piece and then dyes it to see if it'll take the dye properly. It's a sample. Afterwards, that piece is supposed to go back to the balabas.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you're not allowed to buy it from him. You're not allowed to buy from him a dugma, which is a sample, namely that the owner brings him wool and brings him a sample of another piece of wool that's already dyed the same color. I want this dyed this color. Like nowadays, when you go to a paint shop and you bring a little sample of the paint or whatever. So you're not allowed to buy that from him either, same thing. But like tlushim shel tzemer, or pieces of wool that were torn off, little pieces that were torn off what was sheared off the sheet, because again, they probably don't belong to him. Beged savur tavi begadim. But you're allowed to buy from him a garment that's already been dyed, or tavri. You're allowed to buy from him thread that's already been spun and dyed, or begadim, or clothing. Again, the question is, hashta tavri shaka begadim abaya. If you're allowed to buy from him even spun yarn, how much more so you're allowed to buy from him fully made clothes? The answer is, my begadim namti, because clothes over here means you could buy from him felt. Felt doesn't get woven. You take, you know, like how felt hats are made. They take wool or whatever it is and press it in a press. It doesn't go through the stage of being spun or woven or anything. Nevertheless, you're allowed to buy that from him because again, that's enough of a shinri.
Even if it's stolen.
Even if it's stolen, right? Turn it on. Nois and Otis la'abdon. If you give leather to a leather worker to tan it, akitsuin. So the little pieces that he cuts off the edges to even it out, batlushin, or the wool that comes off the leather while you're preparing it, harayel shabala bayis, those belong to the balabais. Oilo mashatif samayim, but with the bits of wool that come up when you're washing the hide, the skin in water, when you're preparing it, making it into leather, those you'll have to keep, because that's a small thing. We assume the owner is masculine. We said that we mentioned about three threads on the end that the laundryman is allowed to take, and we said if it's black threads on a white garment, you're allowed to take all of them. Omer Rabbi Yehuda, katsra shnei, but katsra shakulei. A laundryman in Aramaic is called a katsra. And therefore, appropriately, he's allowed to take what he shortens from the clothing, these three threads, he's allowed to keep them for himself. So the fact that he's called Katsura helps us remember this din that he can take those extra threads from the end.
Those that he cuts off,
yeah. Katsura that he makes the garment shorter. Amar Rav Yehuda, hakol olin l'minyan chelet, everything, meaning even those threads, if the laundryman didn't cut them off, they all count towards the measurement for chelet. Chelet meaning tzitzis. Tzitzis, we know, have to be a certain minimum and a certain maximum distance they're supposed to be from the edge of the garment. The minimum is kesher gudol, the size of one joint on the thumb. The maximum is three etzbos. So Rabbi Yehuda is saying those extra threads on the ends count towards those measurements. However, Yitzchak Bri Kapid Alayo, but my son Yitzchak is particular about them. So Rashi explains particular as in he takes them off before putting tzitzis on because he thinks they don't count towards the shiurim. So he cuts them off and then starts measuring from after they're cut off. There are other mafarshim who explain that what he means is kapid alayo means he's makpid in both senses. He's not sure whether they do or they don't count, and therefore he makes sure to get rid of them first, so that we're clear where the kesher gudol of three etzbos starts. The Mishnah said a chayet shir at a chotchola, that if a tailor left over enough of a thread that you could still sew with it, and he has to return it to the balabas. A kamal litvar, how much is considered enough to sew? Amar Rav Asi, maloy machat chutz v'chutz l'machat, really it's supposed to be the length of the needle plus outside the needle. So now they have the question. What does that mean? Maloy machat v'chutz l'machat kim loy machat. Does it mean that there has to be enough thread, the full length of the needle plus another needle's length? Of the leftover thread. In other words, if a needle is 3 inches long, do you need the minimum amount that you have to return to the balabas? Then it would be 6 inches. Any shorter than that, you can keep, because you can't really. You could sew one or two stitches with a smaller amount, but we only consider it to be significant if it's twice the length of the needle. Or maybe it means just the length of the needle plus a little bit, which is maybe enough to sew one stitch. But maybe that would be considered significant. Tashma, the Tanya, Achayet Shir, the Chut Pachas Mekleilis Barboi. If a tailor leaves over from the thread less than the amount that you could sew with, or he leaves over a piece of cloth less than
the needle.
Well, that's what we're going to figure out. Right. or he leaves over a piece of cloth less than 3 by 3 itzbois. So if the balabas minds that he keeps them, is makbid on them, then they belong to the balabas. And balabas makbid alayin and ereh shaloi. So, so if you're going to say that the shiur of our Mishnah, the amount that you have to return to the balabas no matter what, is twice the length of the needle, then fine, then we can understand the b'raisa. Because at least, even less than that, it is useful. You could use it for those little stitches that we said before to put the loops onto the cloth when you're stretching it out. So therefore, it would depend whether the balabas is makbid on it or not. But if our Mishnah itself meant that all you need is slightly more than length of the needle, then a bit of thread less than that is not useful for anything. Why, even if the balabas is makbid on it, who cares? Therefore, it must mean the full length of the needle plus another needle's length, which is what the Mishnah is saying. Shmami, no, that proves it. So that amount you have to return no matter what. Less than that depends what he thinks. Yeah.
It depends what he thinks.
That's what the Braisa said. Yeah. Masha Choroshkola, we said in the Mishnah that what a carpenter takes off with the matzah, with the adze, he's allowed to keep, but what he takes off with an axe, he has to return to the balabas. Or a mini, but I have a contradiction. Braisa says, Masha Chorosh Moitz the matzah, what a carpenter takes off with his adze, Vanifsek the Megera, or what he cuts off with a saw when the wood is too long and you cut off a piece. Those have to be returned to the balabais. But the sawdust that comes out when you're drilling, when you use a plane, here's where we're talking about the plane. So a plane is different than a matzad, which is just little shavings.
What's the difference?
A plane just produces little shavings of wood. Vanifsek the Megera. What comes off a saw, again, the thin sawdust that comes out when you're sawing, the craftsman, the carpenter, is allowed to keep. So the Mishnah had said that what's produced by a masad goes to the carpenter, and the Braita is saying it goes to the balabas. The difference is like this. Ba'asra the tani didan ikatauti chatzini. Where our Tana, the Tana of our Mishnah, lived, there were two types of adzes, two types of axe-like tools. L'rabasi kore l'kashil, l'zutrasi kore l'masad. The big one was called a kashil, an axe. The small one was called a masad, an axe. So therefore, the Mishnah distinguishes between them because each one produces different size pieces of wood. Asr, the Tana Bara, Chadhu, where the Tana of the Braisa lived, there was only one such tool, the Ikka, that there was, the kore l'masad, and they just called it masad. They just called it ads. So over there, an ad could just as well meant the large kind, which was the large pieces. They didn't have the small kind over there. Therefore, the Braisa is saying you have to go to the balabas. Okay. We said if he's working by the balabas or as a day worker or whatever, then everything goes to the balabas. People who cut stones the size for building. There's no issue of gezel with them, meaning they're allowed to keep
masons.
Yeah, so they're allowed to keep the bits of rock that they shave off. Mefaske lonis, also people who cut off extra branches from trees, or mefaske gfonim, or who cut them off from grapevines. Menakshe higi, or people who cut down thorn bushes. Menakshe zroyim, or people who pull out weeds from among the growing plants. Veodre yirokas, or people who pull out the extra plants, like they're growing too close together, so you don't want them to all end up stealing nourishment from each other. So you pull out the weaker ones and leave the stronger ones. All those, in all those cases, if the balabas minds, if he wants you to give him those things that you took out, then it's gezel. If not, then you can keep them for yourself. Kshus is a plant that they used to use in those days in making beer. So it's like a wild parasitic plant. It grows on other bushes. So that, and chaziz, meaning very young green tua, like when the grain is growing before it even reaches the stage of producing grain, all it is just green stalks, and behem mishum gezel. Then ordinarily there's no issue of gezel with them, because we assume a person wouldn't mind that if you take some. eventually it'll grow into something, but there's usually a lot left over. There's a lot left anyway. They don't mind if some of it is taken. But in places where they do object, then there is an issue of gezel. You should know, is a place where they are makbid on these things. Why are they makbid? Rashi says, because it's a place where there are animals, and they need good pasture. And therefore, they need chaziz over there. They can't just give it away freely. So we'll do a proper siyum after ma'ariv, but just briefly, a bunch of mefarshim ask the question, starting with Marsha. Usually, the Gemara tries to end off a masechta with a dover toy. Of all things over here, why are we ending with the kafti, who that they're makbid on this? So first of all, Marsha says that is why Rashi took the trouble to add the word toy, because he said sukh in the mirror, they need pasture. He added the word toy in order to end with a bit of a toy. The Gemara itself doesn't, Marsha says, because we learned before kula nizikin chada masechti. The whole seder nizikin is really one long masechta. Therefore, it doesn't have to end with a dover toy, just like individual prakim don't necessarily. But still, Rashi added the toy over there. Marsha does add, though, he says that's why, because the chachamim did do one thing, though. They added at the end, the last four letters over here are yud, and the yud of kafti, and then hey vav aleph, which represent, therefore, the names of Hashem, Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, and Ekia, in order, in that sense, to be Messiah, the Dover Toy.
Yud-Kei,
no, it's not spelling out in full Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, but it's spelling out part of the name Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, and part of the name Ekia, which is Aleph-Hei, Yud-Hei. So therefore, so it represents the fact that after all, that we are ending off with a good thing in that sense. All right. We'll go Davin Meyer once they're done out there, and then afterwards, if everybody can return here, we'll make a proper siyum and talk more about why. We'll start a little bit above the sea as well. Yeah.
And then we'll talk about
the Rebbe made a hadron once on this mesechta, so we'll have what to talk about what the Rebbe said on it. There's something in connection of that the Maharam Shif said on it, which is also appropriate. Partially appropriate towards Yom Kippur, which is coming up soon. So yeah, we'll have what to talk about.
That's the nice beginning of the world, no?
Yes, indeed. It's also my father's first yard site. So it should be Leilei Nishmas Tovia Ben Chaim.
Yeah,
tonight and tomorrow.
Well,
I'm davening. I'm going to be davening by the Yom now. Yeah.
Tonight is what?
Tonight is Chafei. Yeah.